We're going to talk this evening about a little bit more about creation. Been accumulating things again to talk about. And Orlando had a friend that he was discussing some things about whether creation really could possibly exist. And I decided, you know, it's about time I put all these things together and talk about it. There's so many hints in the present world about the fact that there is a creator. It's almost surprising that they're so often overlooked. But people have this tendency to only see what they expect to see. We have a school system that pushes an agenda, in fact, many agendas. One of those is teaching students evolution. They don't really teach students to analyze and think on their own. They're told what they need to hear. In fact, what I was amazed at was, well, not totally amazed, but when Orlando's friend, when he mentioned several of the things that he had objections to, I'm looking at it and saying, these are word for word almost rote repetitions of things that I know other people have said. It didn't come across as his own ideas. There are things I heard in school back ages ago, in the dark ages. You know, it's people have been repeating this over and over again. And so we're going to take a look at just a few evidences again. I pieced together several that I chained together that I thought would be interesting. We're going to talk about first the Brazil nut tree. This is a tree that grows up to 160 feet tall. So if you get an idea, this building is 50 feet one end. So we're talking about three times longer than this building. That's how tall it is. Okay. It lives in the Amazon rainforest, and it can live up to about 500 years to 1,000 years. Okay, so this is not a short-lived tree. Okay, it grows straight up with no branches for over half the height of the tree, and then the top part of the tree has the branches. So this is a Brazil nut tree above regular tall trees. And to give you an idea how big the trunk is. Okay, so this is a type of tree that we're talking about. It takes about 14 months for the seed pods to mature after the flowers are pollinated, which is one of the reasons why you don't find them in the warmer or the cooler climates, because it takes 14 months just to get a seed pod. The seed pods are like small cannonballs in size. And when they fall to the ground, remember they're 100, 150 feet up in the air? And they fall down? They can reach about 50 miles per hour as they're coming down. You don't want to be under one of those trees in the rainy season when they start dropping their seed pods. And, of course, for that, then they need a really thick outer coating in that seed pod to protect the seeds so that when you get down to the ground, it doesn't go smash and you lose all your seeds. In fact, that seed pod is so thick that there's not too many animals that can get through it and open it up. But there is a rodent in the Amazon, a gaudy. It's a large rodent, has chisel-like teeth, and it can crack open those pods. And it's kind of like a squirrel. It eats some of the nuts, but buries the remainder for later. But then oftentimes forgets where it buries it. And after being in the ground for several years lying dormant, a new Brazil nut tree starts to grow, and which brings the next one along. Now, the other interesting thing about the Brazil nut tree is that its flowers are heavily hooded. I couldn't get a real sharp picture, but I got another one here that's a little bit clearer. It's got a very heavy hood on it. This thing is spring-loaded, if you would. There's not too many insects or bees that can actually get into the flower to get the nectar. In fact, in the Amazon, there's one genus of the orchid bee that has enough strength to open the hood and have a long enough tongue to reach down to get the nectar. Here's what it looks like on the inside. This is a slice of it. It has to get into the flower and then stick its tongue all the way in here to get to the nectar. There's not any other bee that can do this. In fact, in that genus, it's only the female orchid bee that's able to do this. So it's the female orchid bee that's able to collect the nectar. And while it's at it, then it pollinates the orchid flower. These orchid bees only live in undisturbed areas of the Amazon rainforest, because they have to have orchids in the area, because the male of that species has to pollinate a particular set of orchid flowers, and while it's doing it, it picks up the scent off those orchids, and only once the male has enough of the scent of these particular orchids will the female breed with it. And it's the female, like I said, that pollinates the Brazil nut tree flower. But the male has to go after some orchids to get the female interested in breeding. So without the male bees, the orchids can't reproduce. Without the orchids, the bees can't reproduce. Without a female bees, the Brazil nut tree can't reproduce. And without the agave, the Brazil nut tree can't grow into new trees. You have all these interdependencies, one depending on the other. And what the reason why I'm bringing all this up is, you know, evolution says that each of these things develop on their own by random choice. They become, because of circumstances, they become refined to whatever they did. So which came first? Have you started thinking about it? Which of the, if they're growing up into this system where they got, you know, this is dependent on this, which is dependent on this, which is, who came first? It's worse than the chicken and egg problem. And yet somehow this evolved. And the answer is, it can't. This is a very tightly designed system with strong interdependencies. And each of them are different. They're designed to fit together as a whole. One of the interesting things is that as mankind, we have a lot of use of gears. We make gears for everything nowadays. Okay. In fact, they date all the way back to the earliest ones they have dated so far is about 300 BC. It started in Alexandria, Egypt. The Greeks in that area developed it. Well, it turns out there's actually a hopping insect. It's only 3 millimeters long. So we're going to the opposite end of the scale. We went from, you know, the gigantic tree. Now we're, this is a little teeny tiny hopping insect. In fact, it's called a plant hopper. Isis Cleopatris is what it's named. Most hopping insects, if you look at them, in fact, here's one that looks like it. But this thing's, it's blown up, but it's only 3 millimeters long. That's an adult. Most hopping insects have long legs that extend outside the body. And those long legs, when they hop, makes it a little bit easier for them to adjust their trajectory. So which way they're going to hop. But the plant hoppers have little short legs underneath their body. And so in order, here's the little short legs. And so in order for them to jump accurately, those rear legs have to fire basically simultaneously in order for them to make an accurate jump, which gets a little bit difficult. So what they found is there's actually a gear between their legs. In the nymph, the junior version of this plant hopper, there's a gear. When they get ready to jump, the gears mesh together. And so then when it fires, the gears make sure the two legs go together at the same time. Here's a farther away picture of that. So there's little ratchets here that push the gears together so that then they pull down and they hop. And when they hop, it meshes the gears and the two legs go together. And so it hops accurately. And as they were looking at this and saying, oh, wow, you know, nature beat mankind. Surprise. To this. But so the gears allow the legs to move within. Actually, by the way, plant hoppers can jump at speeds of 8.7 miles per hour. That's how fast it can travel. And the gears allow their legs to move within 30 microseconds of each other. It solved really a complex problem that the brain and the nervous system can't solve. It's just not fast enough to coordinate those things. But what's interesting also with it is that those gears, we can't see in these pictures, but those gears have little fillets, curves at the base of them. Well, in man-made gears, we found out you have to put these little tiny curves in the base of the teeth of the gear. The fillet gears actually make the gears last longer. This little insect has fillet curves in it so that those gears last longer. Now, those gears are only found in the juvenile form of that plant hopper. The adults don't have the gears. You see, and they've looked at them and they tried to figure out why. The adults actually have a series of pins that lock the legs together. But the juveniles have gears. And the hypothesis currently is, well, the gears are a little bit more fragile. They might break a tooth or two over time. But that's not a problem for the juvenile plant hopper because it molts. And so it sheds and goes through several stages where it replaces the exoskeleton. It doesn't matter if the gears break a few teeth here or there. It's like, you know, so what if you lose your baby teeth? You're going to get your adult teeth. You know, same type of idea. And so it's not until they get big enough where the pins can work, which last longer, do the adults have the pins and drop the gears, which would not last long enough for an adult. And I'm looking at this article, and I read the articles, and every one of them just talks about, you know, all this, you know, the design aspects of it and how it works and all the various things. And right at the end of the article, it says, these parts have evolved and were not designed. Right after talking, I mean, literally the paragraph before it, talked about how similar they were to human design gears. Oh, wait a minute. Take that second paragraph. These weren't designed, they just evolved. Well, that's the logic they used. How can you look at one thing, talk about the design, and then look at the other ones, oh, it just happened? You know, isn't it amazing how random events can solve really complex problems? So why doesn't random answers on a test get you past a course? The next one I wanted to look at is the DNA. We're going to get really small now. I'm a programmer by trade. That's what I learned. Still teach it. Programmers come up with numerous schemes to improve the efficiency of the code that they're writing. And one of the problems today is not quite so much of a problem, but it comes up frequently in programming. In fact, we laugh about it, that all programs grow to exceed the size of available storage. However big you make it, we'll make the program bigger than what can fit in storage. So you're constantly looking at some way to crunch things down, the packet down, such it still can fit in the storage that's available. And the better you can do that, the more efficient the code is. And one way to do that is to divide code up into modules that are used repeatedly in different sections of the program. And this nesting or overlapping of code then reduces the size drastically of the resulting product. Well, not very long ago, it was discovered that in DNA, you know, they're starting to map the genes and all that. Well, they found out a lot of the genes overlap. See, this section here, and it's, I forgot what bacteria it comes from, but there's a gene that's called ATP8. It's in red. There's another one that's called ATP6. It's in blue. Notice the red starts here. The blue starts here. Same segments. Then the blue continues on past where the red ends. They overlapped. This overlapping is actually done several different ways. It can sometimes be, DNA is two strands that are pulled apart. So sometimes the overlap is by shifting down the sequence to start another segment. Sometimes it's produced by taking the other side of the DNA. So one side produces one set of enzymes, the other side produces a different set. Sometimes it's going on the other side and then reading it backwards instead of forward. Is producing all these things. And so you get these nested periods. This is one out of a bacteria. And these are the products of the DNA that they've so far have identified. And notice there's several overlaps. This one right here, there's three of them all together in one section. Completely different molecules, completely different enzymes are being produced. But they're coming from the same segments. just overlap, just start a little bit differently, start a little different, read it backwards or whatever. Now, the reason why I'm bringing this up is that one of the problems that evolution has always had was how do random events make complexity? And the fad was basically, the thought was, well, hey, we'll just say that you make a change and that change becomes viable. Some of the changes are bad, so the thing dies off, but some of the changes once in a while actually are good. Well, when you have overlapping code like this, if I go and let's just say they usually refer to this as junk. We'll go and talk about that in just a moment. But if I change something here, probably won't make much of an impact. You know, change something here, go change one of the molecules. Might have a drastic impact. What if the mutation's here? How likely am I going to make one change that I can still keep three different molecules in a not just functioning, but functioning better than they used to? You start calculating the odds out. There's more atoms in the universe than the chances are of that happening. Very quickly. Mutations are very, now that they discovered that there's overlapping genes, suddenly the idea that a mutation improves something, the chances of that are about nil. It's mathematically impossible. And it gets more complex than that. Every plant, every creature has one set of DNA. If I got a piece of your, say, like your blood, I know exactly who that person is because I can look at his DNA, right? Well, have you ever thought about it? That one set of DNA makes your skin cells, makes your eyes, makes your kidneys, makes your heart, makes your muscles, makes your hair. How does it know from that one set all those different functions? Because the cells that are doing the heart are certainly different from the ones on the skin, which are different from the ones that are producing bile in your gallbladder. They're all different, but they're using the same DNA. And what they found out is the DNA actually folds itself so that different sections are exposed. And so when it determines that, hey, I need a heart muscle, it folds this way. And I need a kidney, it folds that way. Have you thought about how you can code so that you can get a whole bunch of different... I'm going to write one master program. And it's going to work all the different ways. All you have to do is you just start in a different spot and go in a different direction. I'm not signing up to write that. It's the whole idea of doing that, it's just getting everything just right. And then you're going to introduce what evolution says. I'm going to introduce in that that whole thing where I can just randomly change something and it'll still work. Not only just randomly change it and it'll still work, it's going to work better. No. It would be near impossible for a human to sit down and put one together. That's why we can't make life, by the way. We can't even get it together. We can start with something that already is living and piece pieces together. But nobody's built one. No one's taken, say, let's take all the little pieces and chain all the little DNA molecules together. We're still trying to figure out what's there. Which, by the way, let me mention something else. Decades ago, there was a fad that we all had vestigial organs. Leftover organs, because this idea is, hey, we're developing and we're evolving. You know, some things get turned off and we just don't need them anymore. And so we're getting rid of, we're carrying around some leftovers with us. It was the theory. And it was really essential for evolution to say there had to be leftovers as to things are evolving. And so there came up with a list, and I think the list, I was going to go back and try finding it. I couldn't find the count. But the original count of vestigial organs was like there was 90 different ones in the human body. And as time went on, and as we got better and better at our science, you know how many of those vestigial organs are left? How many organs we have in the body that we realized have no use? There's none. The last one was the appendix. For a long while, they thought, oh, that's just a leftover little piece of junk. No, it has a central role in your immune system and stores your bacterial gut, or the bacteria for your gut. And it actually has a central role. You can survive without it, but hey, that's just the robustness of the design. We can get by with a little bit less than what we should have. But it doesn't mean it's not useful. Okay, well, so we ran out of vestigial organs for people. We have junk DNA. That's where it's at. Those leftover, you know, the DNA has to be modifying. So we got little pieces of segments there. They're just leftovers that don't have any real use. What they're finding out now, with all this overlapping and realizing that, oh, well, depending on what type of cell specialization is going on and it twists and it turns, they're getting to realize that, hey, you know what? I don't think we're going to have any junk by the time we get done with this thing. And like I said, that's essential for this idea. If we're going to randomly change things, the theory would essentially say there has to be leftovers that are not used anymore. If everything is being used and everything fits and has a purpose, then that points to a design. A very skilled, genius designer to fit that all together, and it works. Basically, all these arguments were based on our lack of knowledge. And over time, those arguments are shown to be false. Like I said, the density of information that's encoded in the DNA, every one of your cells, you know how much the amount of information that's stored in there is absolutely mind-boggling. Now, sometimes you talk about in biology class, they talk about the simple cell. I was watching a video the other day. He points out, there is no simple cell. Every single cell out there is mind-boggling complex. And it's all formed and controlled by that DNA. Everywhere we look, we find indications of a genius designer. And we have yet to figure out everything he has done. And I don't think we're ever going to get there. Take a look at Job, chapter 26. Job 26, and look at verse 14. Behold, these are the fringes of his ways, and how faint a word we hear. But his mighty thunder, who can understand? We can barely comprehend a piece of it, just the edge of it. We have no clue as to what the big picture is. And in Romans chapter 11, Romans chapter 11 and verse 33. Oh, the depths and the riches, both of wisdom and knowledge of God. How unsearchable are his judgments and unfathomable his ways. That's what the Bible is telling us. There is so much to what God has done. We're just looking at the results of it. Think how long mankind's been on this earth. I know people say, oh, it's been, you know, hundreds of thousands of years. That makes it worse. But we've been around for, you know, thousands of years. We're just barely scratching the surface of what God has done in some sections of what he's designed. And God, what we also notice is God's involved in all the little details. You know, trying to put all those DNA together, that's detail work. Putting the little fillets in the gear tooth, that's detail work. And take a look at what Isaiah said. Isaiah chapter 40 and in verse 26. Lift up your eyes on high and see who has created these stars. The one who leads forth their hosts by number. He calls them all by name. Because of the greatness of his might and the strength of his power, not one of them is missing. Anybody have a count of how many stars up there in the universe? Know every one of their names? Got a name for every single one of them? No, it doesn't count when you say you are 623. God has names for every one and keeps track of them. Why do you say, O Jacob, and assert, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, and the justice due me escapes the notice of my God? Do you not know? Have you not heard? The everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, does not become weary or tired. His understanding is inscrutable. If God can keep track of the entire universe, if he can look at all the little fine details and watch over them, why do you think that? Why do sinners think that God's not going to notice them? Instead of pretending God doesn't exist, we need to bow before him. It's time to give your life to the one who gave you life. I hope you'll think about these things. Is there anyone here tonight who's not yet a child of God? There's no better time than right now to put on Christ. For those who are children of God and would like the prayers of your brethren on behalf, why don't you come forward as we stand and sing the song that was selected.